Another view of poetry today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Justin Hetledge is in his last year of high school, but is really just getting started on a life in poetry. He joins us today on Scribble. Justin, if you would read your poem, Drenched.
Down drips riding soundless waves. Of clashing smatters we derive vehemence. Of derived vehemence we've spout splashing tears that abound without case, wear without method. Flashed elegant spears descend upon the darkened world. Ignited balms coil on spoiled rage, like so many colorful adjectives perusing the sketches of gods. Misfortune brings change, but change without intention is chaos. Yet what is stagnation? Unholy beings drawn from unexposed threads hide among the stars, hide the stars with undrained feathers. The world patters on, rolls on in these drenched gray pastures.
You know, Justin, I have taught high school, and I remember how hard it was to get students to even read poetry. And here you are writing it. How did that come about?
Well, honestly, I've always kind of liked poetry. I like all kinds of art, and poetry is just kind of special because words can have so many different meanings, and you can create images just with, and so many different images just with the same set of words. I didn't really start writing poetry till the end of the last year of high school, when I took an American literature class and kind of read a lot of classic American poetry, and that kind of inspired me to try to write my own.
Well, Roald, there's a student.
What poets did you read that led to poems like Drenched?
We read a lot of the classic American poets like Emily Dickinson, and I mean all of the ones that are pretty well known. I can't really say like any of them in particular like had the same type of style that inspired me to write them the way I do. But it just was reading their poetry and how they could create, like, using their own words and their own forms that kind of led me to come up with my own and trying to make my own.
Well, was Whitman in the mix someplace?
Yeah, definitely.
Because I feel a lot of Whitman-y phrasings in here. Whitman was, it turns out, really an opera fan. And so a lot of his rhythms and stuff are operatic. And that's how you get that great list of catalogs and stuff from Whitman. And so I can sort of, you know, I haven't had a chance to read these a lot, but I can sort of trace these from Whitman down through the San Francisco poets, Ginsberg, Allen Ginsberg, for instance. Have you read Allen Ginsberg?
No, I don't think I have.
Well, you should read Ginsberg because you're sort of in his tradition. This is different from, I think, almost any poet that we've had. Let me start with the basic question. What makes what you just read a poem? What makes anything a poem? It doesn't rhyme.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely seen a lot of poems that don't rhyme, but...
Well, they mostly don't today, but I mean...
Yeah.
So what for you makes this...
I just see poetry as a type of art form. I mean, it's like writing, but it's not in sentences, it's not in paragraphs. It's just its own... It's just like using phrases and words and in a way to put a certain image in your head or convey a certain concept.
When you get an image in your head, you know, how do you convey it to another head? I look at this and I think people will think, wait a minute, where's the subject, the verb, the noun, the object? It isn't that. It's more elusive. It's a... You get phrases, and each phrase seems to contain its own meaning. And how do these occur to you? Do you just write what you hear in your head, or do you play with words, or what?
Yeah, it's kind of spontaneous, I'd say. I try to use some word plays if I can, like I said, coil on spoiled, like just kind of sometimes those types of plays I feel like kind of enhance the poem, but it's mostly just about the words I use and in what order and in how I put them in each line.
It's interesting. I remember when I heard you read at Quinton City Poets, I believe the phrase I used was Ciceronian. Cicero believed that none of the Latin poets or the Latin writers were really using Latin properly. And he seemed to fold words within words. And when you unpack Cicero and try to translate him into English, it's hard. It's really hard. And when you pack so much into a few words here, you have to stop and think. And that's why I believe not only hearing your poetry is important, because it's important to hear how you phrase things, but then as you read it, you have to take your time and read carefully, because there's something packed in almost every little sequence of words. Let's go to another one. Let's see. How about... Here's a short one. Well, let's do the key to a key is that it's a key, which a title I very much like.
Yeah, that title, honestly, I changed it the other day, but honestly, I might change it back. It's kind of, titles are very hard for me to pick the one that really I feel like fits the poem.
What did you change it to? I'm curious.
I just changed it to 88 keys to an instant in time. It kind of has the same connotation with the keys, I'm not sure which one I prefer, to be honest.
Okay, well, read us the poem, and maybe we'll make up a title.
All right, sounds good. They thud softly, my fingers onto black and white, white and black onto an electric purgatory. Deported, my thoughts de-exist, and the vibrations caress, ingest, incinerate the undisturbed righteousness on either side of my face. Every eye excavating interpretations of mind, every mind digesting the fibers of a soul, an emblem long lost to the dirt and to the numbers, but never to the wind it writes. A fantastic inebriation, dizzying, illogical ratios and incandescent adjectives, compiled rubato, styled in a moment.
Now that's, I get that. I get that, having encountered a piano. But that is, you move so swiftly away from the beginning. They thud softly, my fingers onto black and white onto an electric purgatory. Wow, that took off like a rocket.
Well, I think, what I like about these poems is that you move back, and they're sort of two camps in American writing. I don't know if you pick that up in the American Lit course you took. But then there's Twain with his, just use plain words. And then there's Faulkner that has a sentence that can go on for 9 paragraphs, right, with big words. And that's because the English language is, this is really an oversimplification, but the English language is essentially split between Anglo-Saxon, the plain, simple words, and the French imports that we adopted. And most of the English language is essentially French, and you move back and forth between the Anglo-Saxon and the French. And what I mean is, you can say in two ways. You can say, if you want to be fancy in French, you can say I'm intoxicated by the exuberance of your verbosity, or if you want to be Anglo-Saxon, you can say you're wordy. Right, same thing. But you use both of these. So incidentally does Shakespeare, the multitudinous seas incarnadine. Shakespeare is a master at moving between very simple Anglo-Saxon words and then this gush of French imports. You do that, electric purgatory and fantastic inebriation, incandescent adjectives. And is that deliberate, or does that just sort of happen as you...
I guess it honestly just sort of happens. I don't really think about, the words I'm using, just I pick the right one.
But look at the second stanza. Deported, my thoughts de-exist. Okay. And the vibrations, now you start into a group of verbs: caress, ingest, incinerate. That's an interesting process. The caress, and then ingest, take in, and then it lights up the undisturbed righteousness on either side of my face. Now, that's an interesting phrase. How did you come up with that?
So kind of what I'm getting at there is just the, like, the vibrations I'm talking about, sound. So it goes to your ears. That's why I said either side of your face. And I guess, like, what I'm setting up is it's just, like, you're in, like, a moment, and it's, like, silent and calm, and then you just start playing. And then that those three verbs, caress, ingest, and incinerate, it's just, like, so contrasting, so different, just all the different types of sounds you can create. And they all just hit you at the same time. And
but that's why it takes a little time, and reading helps in this, because, you know, you hit the keys, they vibrate, and then your thoughts de-exist. In other words, you're not following a linear thinking here. And the vibrations caress your ears. They take them in, and then they spring into fire. And the undisturbed righteousness of your ears are there, and all of a sudden something happens. It's really interesting when you look at this, and I think, how did you come up with the complexity of your poetry? Because your poetry is not, you know, it's not a limerick. It's not a simple thing. It really is pretty deep. And how do you do this? Or do you think about it? Does it just flow?
It really just flows, I feel like. I just get like a certain idea in my head when I want to write a poem. Like I think about a certain experience or a certain idea, like in this case, playing the piano, or more just really sitting down and hitting that first note. And I just kind of start writing about it. And I guess I don't really think about the complexity. I mean, I'll go back and edit it and make it a little bit better, but usually what I write down right away is pretty much what I keep.
Do you remember at all how you edited this particular poem? I mean, do you do a lot of revision?
I don't really do a lot. It's usually specific words that I want to change. Like, if I can't think of the right word, I mean, you know, you get it where you get that block, you know, right, what word you want to use, but you can't think of it. I'll put down a substitute word and I'll go back and change it when I think of the one I really want to put in there. Or sometimes I'll just take things out that I didn't think really added.
I get into so much trouble doing that when I write a column. I can't think of a guy's name, so I'll just put in a name. And then if I forget, it goes to the newspaper, and all of a sudden there's a flurry of, what is this? You know, because it's true that when you go back to edit, you look at it a different way. Take a look at one more poem, Utica.
Sometimes, when the halo of dust is inhaled through my agape window, and the stars of my dreams blend with the stars of our city, reality around us, as the bursting of fall pulsates with my speakers, resonating with love and life and promises, I'm on the other side, it's all right, just hold me in the dark. And the suspended aerials of lambency only manipulate the depression of my foot, while some complex of chemicals, indifferent to trivial principles, continues to churn and tumble with reflections. Dust and stars and fall and life and dark. And as I glance to my right and relive that encounter in a 2 a.m. parking lot, that vision of a summer night where nothing made sense and everything made sense, and all I remember is the crepuscule of my eyes, while every other sense flared with inexperienced wisdom and chaotic order, childish maturity and ignorant passion, and as those soft beats touch, tangent to the impossible past and the passing present, and my eyes gaze past the road in front of me and the road behind me and my own cracked reflection in my rearview mirror. I stare, for I'm all too aware that I'm unaware, and everything is hanging.
That's good.
It is. And here again, you're doing the same thing. You're moving back and forth between Anglo-Saxon and French. You've got lines like the brisk sting of fall, which is nice and plain, and Twain would love it. And then you've got Suspended Orioles of Lambency, which Faulkner would love, right? And is that deliberate, or is that just happening in...
That is something that's kind of just happening. That one line with the Suspended Orioles of Lambency, that's one I did go back and change, because I put in just like something with kind of simple words, like about light, and then I decided I wanted to kind of expand the meaning of that line.
What's interesting about this poem is that you are covering up. You're taking an experience, and you're telling us about that experience, but you're not telling us directly. You're telling it aslant.
Yeah.
And you are moving into an area of impressions and emotions, and we have to kind of suspect what's going on here.
That's Emily Dickinson. Tell all the truth, but tell it slant, right?
I remember that poem.
Yeah. Well, that's what you do in this one. I mean, this poem is pregnant with meaning. It really is. And you've drawn a veil over it.
So how long would it take you? When you sit down, do you just start with the first line, or do you start with an idea? Or
It starts with an idea, but I start with the first line, and I just write it in order. I mean, because you read it in a certain order, so of course you should... I feel like I should write it in that order because, like, I experienced that meaning in the same direction that you would read it and that you'd experience it.
How long would it take you to write this?
It probably took me 15 or 20 minutes.
You know,
poor Mary Oliver. She said in her book on writing poetry that after 50 revisions, a poem begins to emerge. Not with Justin, right?
But this poem was written with two drives, one with memory and with feeling, and a desire to make concrete something that was just in your mind and in your emotions. There's a lot in this poem, Justin. You're going to be found out one day. Be careful. I must say, I'm impressed that you have plunged so deeply into poetry so early. What are your intentions? Are you going to keep this up?
Yeah, I definitely want to. For me, it's just kind of like a hobby. I just do it for fun, and it's a way to have an outlet for my, you know, what I'm feeling.
Do you submit these for anyone to critique or edit? I realize you came to Quint City's Poets, and you hit us with something that was so big and so multifaceted, I don't think anybody knew what to say. Because it's the sort of thing that you think, I can't take this in at once. You know, it was just too big in several dimensions. But do you go to anybody for advice or for editing?
I haven't really a whole lot. I'm pretty close to one of my English teachers at school, and I've shared a few of my poems with her, and we talk about it every now and then, but I haven't really gotten any real, like, besides the Quint City Poets, which I do enjoy going to, I haven't done a whole lot outside of just my own house.
Well, you know, I encourage you, I think we both encourage you to keep on, but at some point you ought to run head on into somebody who's going to take your poems very seriously and critically and see where you go. As you head on into college, I think that's the place to do it. But what do you think, Roald?
I think you shouldn't drop this. What are you planning to do? You're going to college, I assume.
Yeah, I'll be going to the University of Iowa next year.
In what?
I'm going there on a physics major and a music composition second major.
That's interesting. Physics and music, those two go together.
They really do. When I was in grad school, the people that lived across from me were all physics majors, and they're the ones that listen to classical music.
That's true.
There's a real relationship between math and
also
classical music.
Poetry used to be called numbers.
Right.
So there's, you're going into some interesting fields with physics and music and poetry on the side. We wish you the best, because I think this is something you ought to keep at, Justin.
Thanks so much.
And we'll thank you for spending time with us. Justin Hetledge and his poetry. You ought to have a chance to read this sometime. Well, Roald, how about that?
That's impressive.
Yeah, that's there's a complexity there that surprises me in one so young.
Well, I think my theory is he's unaware of it. Although when he started talking about it, he seemed more aware. I thought some of this stuff was just accidentally good, but he seems to sort of know what he's doing in line by line here. So.
Yeah, it is. It just seemed, you know, you talk about a spontaneous overflow of powerful emotion. There it is. I mean, this is just coming out of him. And,
That's Wordsworth, but Wordsworth in the next line said, emotion recollected in tranquility. You need to let it sink in. And we had a poet at Augie once who worked in the reading writing lab, and she said it. Her poems at Augie were all about Nebraska, where she'd been 7 years before. And she said it takes about 7 years for a poem, for an experience, to sort of filter through your mind and through your heart and through your emotions and come out as a poem. So she said, in 7 years, I'll be writing about Rock Island.
But he is young, and these things are coming very quickly. And you wonder how that happens. You know, it's interesting to see that some people take very quickly to musical instruments. There's something about youth, you know, that when you dive into something, it's a quick dive sometimes and a sudden immersion.
Right.
And looking at his poems, I think, boy, there's a lot there that I'm not sure he is thinking about. He's feeling all this for sure.
Yeah.
But this is just coming right out.
Well, I go round and round and round about in revision. I know Rebecca Wee, the poet in residence at Augustana, it takes her at least 2 months, if not more, to write a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And to hear Justin say, well, I 15, 20 minutes. You know, we've had a couple of other poets on that say they do that too. And Sylvia Plath was capable of doing that, apparently. I mean, she'd sit down and write 3 poems in a day. And I don't know how that's done or where that comes from. D.H. Lawrence did the same thing. He explained it by writing a poem called Not I, But the Wind That Blows Through Me. Because I'm not writing these poems. I'm the vehicle. My hand and the pen, you know, come from someplace else.
There are several musicians who have said something like that, you know, that they just, the music just wells up in them and they write it down. And I don't understand that. You know, I know it occurs. You get glimpses of it yourself sometimes when you're in the process of doing something. At some point, the practiced moves and so on give way to something that is more subtle. And it's amazing when it happens.
I've been watching Ken Burns' series on country and Western music.
Oh, yeah.
And which is really well done. And there's 3 more episodes, I guess, to go.
Well, we're talking now well past that. But that's true.
But he, poems like I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, which became an instant bestseller on the charts, he sat down and penned that off in 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that?
I don't know, because, you know, unlike some people I know, I went to the Quint City Poets meetings and I tried to write a poem to submit.
Well, and you did.
I did. But you didn't.
No, I didn't. I have a poem, but I just never got to the meetings. It's hard for me to drive at night, for one thing.
Well, I'll have to pick you up sometime.
Well, maybe
to be sure you
we
get
could go.
There. But you admitted when you were doing the labels on paint cans that you were trying to write poems. What is it that decides you to move toward poetry or toward prose?
As far as reading it or
writing it,
I can't write. I have tried to write a poem. I would get a line and I say, well, that would make a good poem, and I sit down. But as far as prose is concerned, you know, creative nonfiction or whatever you want to call it, that once I get going, that's hard for me to get going too. Writing is hard for me.
Oh, right. I think
really hard.
I think writing is awful.
But once I get going, you know, it seems to work. So I have, you know, people from third grade on have told me that's a good story and stuff. But I, you know, the poems I write are all silly, trashy poems. I can write humorous poems. I once did a imitation, and this was in fourth grade, of William Cullen Bryant's To a Waterfowl. And this is called To a Water, Fowl, about the sewer system in Mountain Lake, Minnesota.
You know, that's interesting because I've written parodies of poems. I think Dover Beach is one that I did and followed everything exactly. The pacing, the timing,
right.
Everything. And it was funny.
Yeah.
It's really funny.
Yeah.
But that is easy. You know, when you take something that exists and you play with it, then just the fun you're having with it makes it pretty
right.
easy to do. But yeah, the business of writing, I don't know. It's sometimes I'm very happy with the writing, but most often it's just a kind of an ordeal that I just like to get over with.
Yeah, when it's going well, it's fun. But,
yeah.
But boy, when it's not, it's like pulling teeth.
When you were teaching, did you have kids writing poems that you approved and edited or commissioned or what?
I didn't ever teach poetry, but I did. If I was teaching American Lit, I might say, you know, one of the options for writing a paper is to write a poem like Emily Dickinson.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get from students very good poems. I just, when he mentioned Emily Dickinson, I happened to remember a poem that somebody wrote, and it was Emily Dickinson, you know, was a recluse, right? She never left her room, et cetera, et cetera. And this was a poem about, supposedly by Emily Dickinson, in which she leaves her room. She decides, I am going out in the world. She goes down, she opens the front door, down the sidewalk. There's the picket fence there. She opens the gate to the picket fence and walks out into the street and takes one look back at the window where she spent her life, and there she is.
Yeah, that's very good.
That was super good.
Yeah.
Why couldn't I do that?
Well, we'll explore that sometime, but right now we've got to get moving. I'm Don Wooten with Roll Tweet. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you'll be here for the next Scribble as well.